So welcome, everyone, to this evening, which is called Studying the Dharma of Happiness. My name is Suvanna Prabha, and I decided that I can't introduce the FWBO again, because I did it the other two nights. But that's what this center is, part of the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. So tonight we're going to have two talks on something that in Sanskrit is called Shraddha, by these two kind people up here who agreed to do that. So I just wanted to get, I just wanted to give a slight bit of background about how we came around to this, and then just a small thing about how it relates to happiness, although that should be probably fairly obvious. In Buddhism, there isn't something like a Bible or a collected group of sort of approved texts. They're just mountains of texts. And they're roughly divided into three categories. There are texts to do with ethical conduct, and there are texts that are stories of the Buddha and his teaching, walking around as he did for 40 years or something, talking to people on what they said and what he taught them. And then there's another group which is more about analysis. So analysis of kind of defining things and putting things together in different ways, and then compiling all that, and then there's commentary on that, and then commentary on the commentary, and there's also different versions of it, which is called Abhidharma. So the Abhidharmikas, or the Abhidharma people, were very into analyzing phenomena, and one of the things that they analyzed, I'm definitely not an expert on this, and I'm going to give you the sum total of the information that I know right now, which is that one of the things that they like doing is breaking down phenomena into sort of more and more into the constituent parts, to help us see the conditioned nature of things. And they broke down mental events. That was one of the things that they were kind of defining and dividing up. Before I get into that, I thought I would just say, so this version of the Abhidharma, what Atrocity and Kika are part of, at least what they're going to be referring to, comes from this book, which is called Know Your Mind by Sangharacharya, which is, at the risk of not making it sound very good, it's a commentary on a commentary. It's a commentary on a commentary on the Abhidharma. However, it is a totally fascinating book. And it covers 51 mental events, which are, and I really seriously hope that this adds up to 51, the five omnipresent mental events, the five object determining mental events, the 11 positive mental events, of which our subject this evening is one, Shraddha, the six negative emotions, the 20 factors of instability, and the four unclassifiable mental factors. I know I definitely sold you on it there, didn't I? Anyway, so since we're talking about happiness for these 6 weeks that we're going to be hearing these talks on the various aspects, tonight we're interested in the first of the positive mental events, which, as I said, is Shraddha in Sanskrit, Sada in Pali. We usually translate it as faith. There are other equally valid translations as well, which maybe we will hear a little bit about. And that's it. Hopefully that makes sense. So we're going to have a talk first by Kika Gasmuri, and then after that, Atrocity is going to say a little bit more about faith.
So I'm going to start with a poem, and I'm going to read it twice in true FWBO form. Okay, so this is by Nagarjuna. Is that the correct pronunciation? He's an Indian sage of the past. The Dharma taught by Buddhas hinges on two truths, partial truths of the world and truths which are sublime. Without knowing how they differ, you cannot know the deep. Without relying on conventions, you cannot disclose the sublime. Without intuiting the sublime, you cannot experience freedom. The Dharma taught by Buddhas hinges on two truths, partial truths of the world and truths which are sublime. Without knowing how they differ, you cannot know the deep. Without relying on conventions, you cannot disclose the sublime. Without intuiting the sublime, you cannot experience freedom. So I like that poem because I like the definition of faith as intuiting the sublime. I like the whole idea of intuition as something that we can really depend on. And that's not what my talk is about. I just like the poem. And I didn't name the talk because I have issues with naming talks because I can never quite name a talk perfectly, so I just don't name them. So Gunther, who Tsongkhapa references quite a bit in the book, and it is a great book and I highly recommend it, says that faith, he translates faith as confidence, trust, with a hyphen in the middle. I thought it was interesting. And he says that it has to come first. So it's interesting because we're all here tonight. So if you walk through the door, you probably have some measure of faith. But maybe we don't know what that's in. But it comes first. So it's what sort of motivates us to even want to meditate or find out more about the Dharma. And he defines it as a deep conviction of what is real, a lucidity or clarity as to what has value, and a longing for what is possible. And Sangharaksha says quite poetically that it's the response of what is ultimate in us to what is ultimate in the universe. So it's a heart response to something sort of beyond ourselves in the universe. And Sangharaksha also says that faith is action. It is karma. And it's tinged with the transcendental and a direct link with the enlightened mind. So, in a way, if you have ever experienced faith, you can have faith that that faith connects you to the enlightened mind. And the importance of faith in Buddhism, I think, is pretty apparent in how often it comes up in lists, and it always comes up first. So it's first in the list of five spiritual faculties, of which I will not go into in this talk. It is first in the 12 links of conditionality, and actually it leads, the next link is joy. So there's a direct connection between faith and joy, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And it's also first in the 11 positive mental events that are talked about in the book. And you can also think of them as like positive emotions, if that's an easier way to connect with that. And metta is one of those, which we did tonight. So again, it's first among the in that list, and it's also considered to be inherent in all of those other emotions. So if you've experienced metta or love, you've also experienced faith, because it's inherent in that. And I liked thinking about that, because it, for me, what really motivates me to practice is a faith in my own capacity, and also a faith in the capacity of all other human beings to be able to really work on and develop our own capacity for loving kindness and wisdom. So in thinking about how faith is inherent in other positive mental events or emotions, it made me think about how all human beings are capable of experiencing positive emotions. We're all capable of experiencing love and joy and equanimity. And so if we're capable of those things and faith is inherent in them, and faith is this direct link to the enlightened mind, then this means that we must be capable of entering upon the path of the Dharma and following it and gaining insight and hopefully at some point reaching enlightenment. So it really is, you can almost sort of reason your way through that faith means enlightenment in a way. It is an aspect of reaching enlightenment. So Sangharaksha also, I'm going to mention him a lot because the talk's based on what he wrote in the book. So he mentions that faith provides the basis for sustained interest and supports the application of effort and also leads to the development of all other positive mental events. So it's good to remember that, again, we have experienced positive mental events, and faith is something that we probably know and have experienced probably more than we think. So it's a lot closer than we might imagine. And a way to sort of bring that, sort of recollect that for ourselves is we could think of something that we really enjoy doing and that we do very well. And we can remember that when we're doing it, we usually don't have any doubt that we're doing it well, and we usually feel pretty happy in that moment. So your interest is sustained in what you're doing, and that applied effort is that comes easily. And this is really a good example of sort of faith in action, so how faith works in our lives in a very simple way, just confidence in what we're doing. So another translation, or the sort of literal translation of Shraddha, is to place the heart on, or to experience a lifting up of the heart. And I really like this particular translation because it's very visceral, it's very physical. And as I said before, in the 12 links, faith gives rise to joy, and we can actually really experience that in our meditation practice, and I have experienced it in mine, and I'm sure many of you have as well. So the next time you're meditating, you could try this. You could begin by reminding yourself of why you practice, what your intention is for practice, what keeps you motivated, and even recollect your spiritual friends and teachers. And then just check in with the heart, actually. And for me, usually I feel an opening up of the heart when I do that, and also a lightening of the heart, or a lifting of the heart. And that is really the opening for joy to arise. And so it really does lift the heart and allow for joy. And I think going on long retreats is a very good way to experience this, because you can really work over time on sort of getting there. Sometimes it's hard just to come to center and sit and try to make that happen. So Sangharaksha also says that faith is the emotional counterpart of reason. So we may think of faith in a Western context as sort of blind faith. I know that that was for me, and I was raised Catholic, and we were sort of expected to sort of blindly just believe in stuff. But faith is not really based on a blind belief. It's really based on applying the Dharma in our lives and seeing its truth through our practice. So another way that Sangharaksha puts it is that it refers to the whole emotional side of spiritual life. So just as we can intellectually understand the Dharma, faith actually opens us up to a more deep intuitive understanding that comes through our actual experience and practice. I forgot to check the time before I started. Can someone tell me how long I've been talking?
You're fine.
Okay. Okay, so I think a talk on faith is probably not complete without a reference to the Kamala Sutta, so I'll just mention it and say a few things. So then in this sutta, the sutta is a story or a teaching. So in this sutta, there's these group of folks called the Kamalas, and they're really confused because there's all these teachers that come through the village and teach them all different stuff, and they don't know what to follow, and they're very upset about this. So the Buddha shows up, and they're like, what do we do? Who should we follow? What should we believe? And he basically says this. He says, Kamalas, when you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness, enter on and abide in them. So basically, if something is skillful, blameless, praiseworthy, and conducive to happiness, then we should accept it as true and practice it. And I really appreciate this because I love the link between something that's skillful and how that relates to happiness. And in the Threefold Path, it starts with ethics. The Threefold Path is ethics, meditation, wisdom, but it starts with ethics. And I always found that interesting. And I was really confused by that when I first started practicing. Why don't we start with meditation? But basically, as our faith strengthens, we become less self-centered, and we can then begin to live a naturally more ethical life. So it really does start with ethics. I think it's important to remember that faith is something that we can actually work on and strengthen. So it's not just something that pops up every once in a while to remind us of what we're doing, but actually it can strengthen. And it'd be good to think about how we can actually strengthen our faith and get really clear about what faith really means to us in our life. So an example of this is the law of karma. And in my own practice, I've definitely seen this happen where first I'd like done something unskillful, and afterwards I feel really bad and I'm like, oh shit, I shouldn't have done that. And I sort of work through that. But with practice, I can actually, I've been able to actually see myself in the moment doing the unskillful thing and can kind of almost feel the volition of that. And maybe I can't stop it because I'm in the process, or maybe I can actually stop it while I'm in the process, like saying something unskillful. And then also I've actually gotten to a point where, which is really interesting to watch happen, where I've been able to develop enough awareness sometimes, very, very rarely, where I can feel, I can get a sense of how it feels right before I do something unskillful and actually stop myself, which is great. It's very, it actually brings up faith up. It's very faith strengthening to have that happen. So, and it shows us a direct sort of result, karmic result of our practice. So it's another sort of just way to basically have faith that our practice is working and that karma is real, and that we are not only capable of liberating our past actions, our past karma, so stuff we've done in the past we can't change, but maybe if we meditate enough and do enough good deeds, you know, that stuff will be sort of recycled out. But we can actually create fresh karma that's that has merit to it. So so it's important to remind ourselves also why we practice and what we think we'll get out of it. And I think it is important also to notice and be aware of and be okay with the fact that those reasons might change. So, for example, when I started practicing, I had this whole thing about wanting to be a better person, and I had this whole idea like I could be a better person. And I realize now, even though I still want to be a better person, and I'm aware of that, that that's a very sort of self-centered way to approach practice, and it comes from this whole idea that there's good people and bad people, and then I was good and now I'm bad, and I mean, then I was bad, now I'm good, maybe I'll be bad again, and I don't know, it's just interesting. And I'm just not really, I mean, I even though I'm aware of that desire, it's not what drives me anymore. It's not what I have faith in. And really, for me, what I have faith in now is just a process of just being with what's happening and trying to respond to it ethically and with sort of mindfulness and metta. And try to just keep breaking down those concepts and moving beyond them. And even just beyond the idea of attaining anything at all. So if we look back over the course of our practice, we can actually see how our ethics deepens, and we can have confidence in the fact that that probably has something to do with our faith. I really like to go to Wikipedia and look words up, because there's always really interesting things, some of which are completely inappropriate. But anyways... So, Wikipedia defines confidence as a mental process that arises from considering if a person or thing is capable of something, and self-confidence as having confidence in oneself when considering a capability, and overconfidence as having unmerited confidence, which means believing that something or someone is capable when they are not. So, I wasn't looking for a definition of overconfidence, but this struck me because I've actually been... I've been accused of having overconfidence. I've also felt myself like I may have too much confidence sometimes. But I actually think this is interesting because if we really believe that we and others are capable of developing wisdom and compassion, then actually we can never be overconfident in our practice because we are capable of it. We can kid ourselves sometimes about where we're at on the path. We can... think that we've gained more insight than we have, and that can be very dangerous, which is more of a delusion or sort of a clinging to an idea of what we get out of our practice. But I actually think that we should think about what would too much confidence actually look like in practice, and really challenge ourselves to think about that. And I think that thinking that we or anyone else is too confident is actually just another idea about ourselves and other people, and I think it really actually comes from doubt. So it's important to just be aware of when that comes up for ourselves, either about ourselves or about other people. And doubt is pretty much the opposite of faith, so that's interesting too. So I think it is important to remember that in a way, and this is one of those interesting Buddhist koans, things that don't really make sense or seem like opposites, because we actually are what we are striving to become. So in a way, faith is both the path and the goal. So it's with us in the beginning of our practice, it's with us in the middle of our practice, and it's with us at the end, if we can even call it an end. And we can even imagine what it would be like to actually always fully, consistently believe that we and all beings are not only capable of, but have in us this innate ability for ultimate, unconditional, and all-encompassing wisdom and compassion. The enlightened mind includes this unwavering and ever-present faith in the capacity of all people. So again, there's that connection with the enlightened mind and faith. Okay, I'm almost done. So if that's too far-fetched for you, we can begin more simply. So we can start even just with simply having faith that we're capable of love, and with practice, we can even see that we're not just capable of sometimes loving some people, but actually that we can experience at times metta that is sort of unconditional and unbiased. And that there's actually no lack of love in us. So, and actually that nothing is lacking in us at all, ever. And that's something that if we don't have faith in it, we could just even ask ourselves, well, what would it be like to have faith in that? To actually think we're capable of that. So it's... also helpful to think about what conditions support our confidence in our own abilities, and what supports our confidence in other people. And also our confidence in the Buddha and what he was capable of achieving. And it helps me also to remember that the Buddha had to have been pretty confident in himself to continue searching for the truth, even though he didn't know what that meant ultimately before he was enlightened, and not to subscribe to sort of any extremes of hedonism or asceticism, and just to kind of forge the middle way that he forged. And just by remembering this, it helps me to remember to have faith in myself as well. Sangharakshita says that the point of faith is to be able to keep going even when our inspiration is dried up. So if you ever wonder whether or not you have faith, you could kind of short-circuit yourself by either doing some chanting or some prostrations or just even checking in with your heart center and how you're feeling and try to create some space around your experience in the moment. And try to have faith in the fact that we know the Dharma tells us that things are always changing, so maybe that feeling will change too, and maybe we'll learn something about ourselves through that process. So you could try that too if you're ever feeling completely faithless. Just go through the motions and see how things change. So another thing that Sangharakshita says is that faith is an emotion that's felt for the highest spiritual values, and that the test of faith is if we're able to act on it without any kind of gratification or pleasurable feeling. And I just wanted to mention a photograph I saw once in a gallery, which I'm sure all of you are aware of, but I saw it in a very large blown-up image of a monk by the name of, I think I'm saying it right, Thich Quang Duc, who is I believe a Vietnamese monk, I'm not sure, who lit himself on fire and sat in meditation in a square in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. I think I'm right about that. I don't know all the details. But I know that he was protesting extreme repression, similar to what's happening in Burma. And when I saw that photograph, I was completely stopped in my tracks because it was so huge, and you could see all of the details of what was happening. And it just really, to me, is like the ultimate symbol of faith, because not only is he doing something for no gratification, but he's doing something extremely painful, which is going to end his life, which to me is very profound. So we can also use visual images to arouse our faith. And just one last point, which is that once we have experienced real faith through practice, through insight into the nature of reality, we may forget about it in our everyday life, but actually we never lose it. So it's always there. So just remembering that can also reignite our faith. And I have questions for the groups. So, should I say them now?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so I'm done talking. So my questions are many. It's funny because I thought there were only two, but each one has like three parts. Okay, so the first one is, what is my relationship to faith? How has my faith deepened over the course of my practice, and how have I changed? And the second is, what are the conditions that support confidence in my practice? And how can I bring more of these conditions into my life?
Thank you. I really enjoyed that. Thank you, Simona Prabha, too, for kind of setting it all up tonight. The links and the threads and the connections, you know, you spoke outside about what's happening in Burma. You mentioned Vietnam, and of course, you know, we have our own war right now, and I haven't seen any of it, but a lot of people are watching the Ken Burns documentary on the Second World War, and I spoke to someone just before coming in tonight who's on the East Coast, who was watching some of it tonight, and she said it was just horrific, valuable but horrific to see that, you know, it was the, about the invasion of France, I guess, the D-Day. And, how I tried to say, well, yeah, maybe we were, well, I knew, but we don't learn from these things, do we? Because we seem to keep doing the same thing in the way of conflict resolution. But we're here to talk about happiness and faith. And actually, before you reminded me and us about the self-immolation of the Vietnamese monk in 64 or whatever it was, and before anybody mentioned to me about, you know, the D-Day, all that was going on, I mean, I have been thinking about Burma lately. I've got a couple of Burmese students right now. I was thinking about 1944 in Paris, France, which is probably not a great place to be at the time, in the midst of the Second World War and under Nazi occupation. And that's the year that was the first production of the play No Exit by Savannah Prava's good friend Jean-Paul Sartre. And she and I like to quote a line from that play when we're feeling particularly flippant, which is, "Hell is other people." Well, the play actually takes place, it's only just three characters plus a valet, and they're trapped somewhere, which is probably hell. But there's just three people. There's no fire. It's just the three of them. And I use that line a lot when I'm being flippant, and I'm flippant far too often, and that's one of the things I've been working on in the 16 or 17 years since I've allegedly become a Buddhist. But I realized that, well, I mean, I know hell is not other people for me. It's not. But what is other people? The noun is wrong for me. For me, faith is other people. That's my faith. That's why I have faith in the Dharma. It's not because all the books on the, you know, that we have in our house and our bookshelves. It's not from all the wonderful retreats that I've been on or lectures I've heard in this room or in other rooms around the country and other parts of the world, although those things are always certainly very valuable. But for me, it's other people. I have faith in the Dharma because I see with my own eyes that it works. I see it in how other people change. People who are right in this room tonight, for example, many people. And they change. And, of course, there's a tenet of Buddhism that everything changes, right? There's impermanence. But I'm talking about change for the better. You know, I mean, you'll, with no effort, you'll change. But changing for the better takes effort. And if you, in my, you know, sort of in the Kamala Sutta, you sort of, you know, I've seen it. I have faith in that because I've seen it happen. I see it happen all the time. And that's really fortunate. Well, it's wonderful, but it's really good for me because I've never ever had much faith in the word faith. I mean, the word faith has connotations for me in general that are not very conducive to growth. They're not very helpful. I was raised without any religion whatsoever, which I'm very grateful for, actually. But I kind of developed into a bit of a cynic. And faith is for other people, for sure. It just doesn't seem, it never seemed tangible to me, this word faith, at all. Kika mentioned blind faith, and if Kika were as old as I am, there was a wonderful rock and roll band named Blind Faith. And that's a good name for a band, Blind Faith. It's a great name for a band, you know, but... Yeah, that makes it even less tangible, right? Blind faith. And then there's poetic faith, which I really like. You know, and I actually didn't realize where that term came from. I always liked that term. And it's actually, it comes from Coleridge, which I should know because I studied him a long time ago. And he was talking about the thing I think about when I go to the theater or the film, the willing suspension of disbelief. That's poetic faith. That willing suspension of disbelief for the moment, which constitutes poetic faith, which I think is wonderful, and it absolutely makes so much work for me and for all of us. But again, it's not faith. You know, it's a different thing. So as usual, I'll back up a little bit. So you do the math going backwards and it just doesn't compute anymore. About 30 years ago, I lived in Sedona, Arizona, which is a treasure of a spot, although a little unique in its way, in northern Arizona, and I worked in Flagstaff, Arizona. In Sedona, when I lived there, and I'm sure now, seemed like, it's an exaggeration, everybody who lived there was into some form of religion or spirituality, from the classic traditional ones to the less traditional ones. Crystals are extremely important in Sedona, Arizona. And it's a small town full of artists and spiritual folks, and it's absolutely beautiful, red rocks and blue skies and green trees and Oak Creek running right through it. And I wasn't any of those things whatsoever. I didn't have an artistic bone in my body. I didn't have a spiritual bone in my body. And I felt a little bit out of place. But at the time, I worked in Flagstaff, which was 29 miles up the canyon. Sedona's 4,000 feet up, Flagstaff 7,000 feet up. That was my commute through this canyon, 45 minutes. And I worked for a place called Coconino County Legal Aid. Coconino County, which has very few people in it, but is huge, is sort of northeast Arizona. And it's the home, or the primary home, of the Navajo Nation as well as the Hopi Nation. And I did a lot of work with those tribes plus individual Indians. And it's, so it's a lot, you know, it's a place, a lot of driving around empty spaces, which is good for anybody, I think, because it gives you time to be with yourself. But it is big. I mean, Coconino County is bigger than, I forget which one, but it's bigger than three New England states together. Obviously, Rhode Island's probably one, but Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, I think. This one county is larger, but emptier. And at the time I was there, the chairman of the Navajo Nation was a man named Peter McDonald. He'd been elected by the tribe. And I was very involved in, you know, things. This is what I believed in. You know, I believed in, you know, sort of legal struggle and political work. And that's what I was doing, or I was trying to do. That's, I didn't use the word faith, but that's certainly what I was trying to do. And Peter McDonald's children, he had three daughters, and his children were named, this is true, Faith, Hope, and Charity. Mm-hmm. So he's covering all the bases. And then I had on my wall in my office, sort of ironically, because I was even then flippant ironic, and it was a quote from Thomas Jefferson. He wrote it a little before he was president, but he said, "It may be regarded as certain that not a foot of land will ever be taken from the Indians without their own consent. This sacredness, the sacredness of their rights, is felt by all thinking persons in America as much as in Europe." Well, we know how that went. And people had faith in those things, right? People have faith in words of people, words of signatories to treaties. So again, I have a little trouble with the word faith. And ironies and threads. That was, however long ago that was, 30 years ago or so, and I had this Thomas Jefferson quote. I was working for the benefit of, hopefully, of Native Americans in Arizona. And now I'm working at a place called Jefferson High School, Thomas Jefferson High School, where the mascot is still, perhaps one of the last in the United States, is the Indian. The Jefferson Indians is where I work. But I'm working on it. But so that's sort of a convoluted little thread, but it leads up to my poem that I'm going to, not a poem I wrote, but a poem that I brought, because I love it and I think it fits. Because there absolutely has been a thread that I've always been following, whether I was aware of it or not, but I knew that I was moving towards something. And this is the... Well, has it disappeared? How could it be? Well, this is very embarrassing. Must have fallen into my bag. It's a good poem. Okay. One brief time out. I'll be right back. Excuse me. I will be back.
We have faith.
Yes. You walk into a classroom or a courtroom or wherever you might walk into. So this is a poem by one of my favorites, William Stafford. And I agree with Kika that our tradition, and it's a good tradition, is to read them twice. But I'll read it once. However, I have copies if anyone would like them later. It's called The Way It Is. The Way It Is. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. I particularly like that little reminder that things will happen. Tragedies happen. Burma happens. Vietnam, Iraq, all the terrible things. And we suffer. We get old. And we will die. And for as long as we're cogent, if we're paying attention, there's a thread we follow, or we can follow. And that's what I have confidence in. That's what I have faith in, that I'm on a path that is good for me. This is interesting. I absolutely appreciate Kika's kind of looking at, trying, you know, that issue, not issue, but that, you know, practicing to make myself a better person and how that can get in the way and all that. But I'm still, I still come from that first, actually. You know, I think it's good for me, and if it's good for me, it's good for people around me. And if it's good for people around me, it's good for all of us, the world. You know, it's not always, and it's often happy and fun, but it isn't always. You know, it's not always a piece of cake. You know, it's not a guarantee of a good time. But there are enough good times to make it worth it, you know. And we have dancing here next week, right? We do, you know. You know, you've seen it on all the T-shirts and the posters, the roughly quoted or transcribed Emma Goldman quote, right? If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. You know, it's not my revolution if I'm not dancing. And that's, and I absolutely agree. I never, ever would be here if there wasn't fun involved. Absolutely not, you know. And so if I can't, you know, if there's no dancing, if there's no joy, then I wouldn't want to be part of this revolution. And that's what this is. Buddhism is a revolution. You know, Sangharakshita says, it's probably not the only one, but awareness is revolutionary. If you are practicing Buddhism, you are a force for change. Revolutionary, not just change because you have no choice, but revolutionary change. And you know, there's a bit of something he wrote that I actually, I'm not even sure where I got this from, but it's one of one of his quotes of that. It's probably from Vision and Transformation. I'm sure it is. His book on the Eightfold Path. But, you know, talking about the goal and the path, you know, we have this perception, a direct perception, I'm paraphrasing obviously, a vision. And once we have that, we can go on. We can continue. We never lose sight of it. We might lose sight of it for a little bit. He uses the analogy of, you know, somebody climbing a mountain, climbing a peak, and the path goes, and you want to get up to the top, and sometimes you can't see that peak. You know it's up there, and you can see it, and sometimes you can't. But you keep going, you know? And maybe you can't see it, oh, but there's clouds, and you can't see it, but you keep going. And that's, you know, as long as we have our eyes firmly fixed on the peak, on the prize, you know, and back to Revolution, you know, keep your eyes on the prize of the civil rights movement. You know what you're going for. And it's not just, oh, we're slogging along through the mud, through the muck. We're happy. We're happy in this knowledge that we're getting there. We're getting there. I want to touch just for a moment on a couple of words that relate to the word faith for me, and that's belief and that's trust. As I've said, I have faith in the Dharma. What I believe in, I think, I believe in mindfulness. You know, that's what I believe in. That's the, interesting, you know, hit that as well. And there's Thich Nhat Hanh, another veteran of the Vietnam experience, who now lives in France, great teacher. He writes, mindfulness is something we can believe in. It is the kind of light that shows us the way. Mindfulness gives birth to insight, awakening, compassion, and love. And that's, you know, if you had asked me a bunch of years ago, do you believe in anything? Yeah, I'm sure I would have said no. And Thich Nhat Hanh, in the same book, Touching Peace, he talks about trust a little bit too. And it's interesting, you're remembering way back when we did the Refuges and Precepts, earlier this evening. And Thich Nhat Hanh writes, when we say, I take refuge in the Sangha, it means we put our trust in a community of fellow practitioners who are solid. We put our trust in a community of fellow practitioners who are solid. And that's what I do. That's what I'm talking about in terms of, you know, faith is other people. Because I do that too, and it makes me happy to do that. And one more thing about faith, it's the opposite, it's the antidote of one of the famous three fetters. I mean, the three fetters that hold us back the most are doubt, self-view, and dependence on rites and rituals. If we could break those three, nothing can hold us back. But it's not easy to do. But one more little look backward. How was it? 2007? About 13 years ago, I went to a retreat in New Hampshire. It was the first time I'd ever been on a Buddhist retreat other than in the San Francisco Bay Area. It was with strangers. I still wasn't sure that Buddhism was anything other than a nice social clubbiness, meeting lots of nice people and enjoying spending time with them. But I really didn't know if it was anything else for me. It was for other people, clearly, but I wasn't convinced yet. And I went on this retreat, and it was led by a man named Vasantra, who's a remarkable teacher and author of the book Meeting the Buddhas, which I certainly recommend, in addition to the book that we've been talking about, Know Your Mind, by Sangharakshita. And the retreat was on the three fetters, doubt, self-view, and dependence on rites and rituals. And in that retreat, it was November in New Hampshire, I understood what people were talking about the Dharma. Especially about doubt and what doubt was doing to my ability to live this joyful and progressive life that I wanted. I didn't break any fetters, but I fundamentally understood that if I continued to have doubt in the Dharma, then if I continued to have doubt that I could really change, then absolutely, that would be self-fulfilling. I couldn't. And on that retreat, I realized I could change. And actually, that was the when I was on the airplane coming back from New Hampshire to San Francisco, my little notebook, I wrote a letter to whoever you wrote to in those days saying, this is it for me. I want to become a Mitra in the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And I, up until then, that was never going to happen in my life, for sure. So that's, you know, the opposite of doubt, without question, is faith. And that's, you know, that was a long time ago, and I've got a long way to go. But I have faith in the Dharma because I've seen that it works. It works in people. It works in people that I'm looking at right now, and people I've been with and met for a long time. I have faith in the Dharma because of the people. I believe in mindfulness because it gives rise to all kinds of good things, including love and joy and happiness. And I trust and rely upon Sangha. And I'm very blessed and fortunate that Kika really explained to you what faith in Shraddha is in the broader as well as personal sense, so that I could kind of speak to it this way. And appreciate it. So thank you. Thank you all.
Really great. Thank you both. We keep on not having time to have discussion groups, which I keep on planning to do. So I don't know if we see if there's anything anybody wants to comment on.
I have one. The thread you speak of, how did that become clear to you? Just the process.
I would say that at different points in my life, even though I've said I don't believe in anything, I'm a cynic and all that, there were things that were really, really important to me and I wanted to figure out how to engage with them. And sometimes it was in retrospect when I said, oh, okay, now that fits in. Yeah, in hindsight, it's real clear to me a lot of ways. You know, to borrow an image from Kike, it's sort of when I know my heart is open, I know that I'm on that path thread. You know, that I'm on that and. Again, I don't know. It's looking backwards. I can see it, and I can see who I was, and where I was going right, and where I wasn't going right. And it's become much more clear. Well, as time goes on, as I get older. And I don't want to make too much of the. I don't mean to honor the things like coincidence exactly. It's not that, but it's connection. Yeah, things just make sense all of a sudden, and sometimes it appears to be a coincidence. I don't want to say, oh, you know, so I don't mean it was meant to be or this, but there, you know, I can see the connections in my life, and I can absolutely see. Thread. There's another thread. You know, those of us, you know, with these cases, you know, the members of the Western Buddhist Order. What is the order? But it's a network of friends. And you know, what is our image? You know, Indra's net is one of the images, right? This kind of the interconnectedness. But it's only valuable if we, you know, pay attention and act on it. I think.
That struck me related is sometimes there's something more crystallized or gel, or things seem to gel. And there's clarity along with the seeking. There's a sense of finding. Sometimes there's a sense of finding. And sometimes there's more of a sense of seeking. I think that. that's what was arising for me, and to really love both is really maybe what allows it to persist. That was really struck when Kierkegaard reminding us of the story of the Buddha. And, you know, it's quite interesting to think, and I think we're all in the same boat, really. Someone's so persistently seeking something that they don't know yet know what it is, but they have a sense that they will know it when they find it. And they have a sense that they have to move beyond the familiar and their comfort zone to be open to something. Being able to become evident and how it's going to reveal itself. So the thread is either, it's both seeking and not knowing what you seek, but just seeking itself, pure seeking. And sometimes the finding, you know, which is often just like a complete freaking miracle, because you're just like, whoa, check that out. Often incredibly frightening.
And there's that faith.
When it works, yeah. When it works, it can be scarier. It can be more comfortable to doubt than to actually see that it works.
Oh, doubt is extremely comforting, I think.
Yeah. You talked about the three fetters. Could you go over this again? I know that's a whole other topic. Okay, well, short explanation.
The three fetters, there are more than three, unfortunately. But the first three, and the ones that are said, if you can break these three, you will not fall back. In terms of stream entry, you will progress. First one is doubt, or it's a fuzzy. Some people call it fuzzy thinking, or just, but doubt, just the indecision, that holds you back. Just what we were talking about so much here about lack of confidence in your possibility, or lack of confidence in possibility of others, or in the Dharma, or any teachings, and your inability to go for it because you have this doubt, because it's more comfortable to be in doubt. Next one, which is, used to be my favorite, but no doubt it's currently affecting this self-view, this idea that, well, you know, those people could be spiritual, and those people could progress. You know, I am who I am, and I, you know, I'm not going to change, I would say. You can't make me. I'm not going to change. I won't. And then the third is, you know, like today. Tonight, for example, we saluted the shrine. We recited the refuges and precepts, those refuges. I go for refuge to the Buddha. I go for refuge to the Dharma. I go for refuge to the Sangha. One time, two times, three times. Well, it's pretty easy to just kind of say those things, rotely, without feeling them, without paying any attention to what it is you're doing. I'll confess that I've done it on more than one occasion. And if all it is the show, or even if you are paying attention to it, I'm saying it's with gusto, or I'm lighting a candle, or I'm offering incense, but if there's nothing behind that, if that's all it is, you're not going to get anywhere. So dependence on rites, R-I-T-E-S, not rites, R-I-G-H-T-S, rites, ritual, then it's, that in itself, even though it's very appealing, this is a really good thing you can be doing, but if that's all it is, no progress is possible. This book, and I, Paul Know Crane. Your mind, Masandar Akshana. As Lord Prabhu said, it's a commentary on a commentary. I think it's one of the most extraordinary books that I've ever read relating to life or the Dharma. I had great difficulty reading it the first time through. And it finally just burst into life at chapter 7. And a friend of mine told me later, oh, you should have just started with chapter 7. And I'm not sure if that's true, but that might be true. I hope it's true because I have recommended people read it that way since then. And then go back to chapters 1 through 6 as you wish, but for me, it just came alive in chapter 7. And
which are the positive mental events?
Oh, I just remember chapter 7. Yeah. And why don't you mention the first three, just because they're so delicious. The first three positive events.
So confidence.
We talked about one.
Confidence, trust is the first one. And there are different possible translations, but the one possibility is self-respect, decorum, non-attachment, non-hatred, non-deludedness, energy, alertness, concern, equanimity, and non-violence.
Good stuff.
So I thought maybe we could end with, I'm just going to read a sentence about what faith is twice. Faith consists in deep conviction of what is real, lucidity as to what has value, and longing for what is possible. Faith consists in deep conviction of what is real, lucidity as to what has value, and longing for what is possible.